All right, as I've been talking this year about miracles, I mentioned to you that there, you know, are just several periods of time in Bible history when they were like miracle rich. Creation, Moses, and we've already talked about that, and then tonight we'll also start in the miracles of Elijah and Elisha. There are just many of those. And then the other period of miracles was during the time of Jesus and the early church. So what I'm saying is in the book of Judges and even in the historical books, there's not many miracles, but there are some. And miracle number 41 is really one of my favorites. I can remember hearing about this as a kid, and I thought this was such a neat story. And this is the miracle of what we call Dagon's fall. This was a Philistine god, a stone god. So let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. Well, the historical context of this, Israel and the Philistines are fighting. They seem like they were always fighting. And the Philistines had won the battle and actually had stolen the Ark of the Covenant. So this is what this story is about. So let's pick up here in chapter 5, 1 Samuel, beginning in verse 1. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Now that would be over in what we would call Lebanon today. Brought it into the temple of Dagon and placed it next to his statue. When the people of Ashdod got up early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen with his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and returned him to his place. But when they got up early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen with his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. This time Dagon's head and both of his hands were broken off and lying on the threshold. Only Dagon's torso remained. That is why still today the priest of Dagon and everyone who enters the temple of Dagon in Ashdod do not step on Dagon's threshold. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod. He terrified the people of Ashdod and its territory and afflicted them with tumors. Now, you know, what this word really means is hemorrhoids. Does that sound familiar to you? Yeah, of course it does. And so that's the real word, hemorrhoids, and we get a word from that. When the people of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, "Hey, the ark of Israel's God must not stay here with us because his hand is strongly against us and our God Dagon." So they called all the Philistine rulers together and asked, "What should we do with the ark of Israel's God?" "The ark of Israel's God should be moved to Gath." So they replied, so they moved the ark to Israel's God. After they moved it, the Lord's hand was heavy against the city of Gath, causing a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city from the youngest to the oldest with an outbreak of tumors, hemorrhoids. So, you know, this is just one of those kind of almost humorous kind of miracles in the Bible. Because, like, they stole the ark of God, and then they said, "What are we going to do with it? Like a hot potato. We don't want it. You can hear it. Here, you have it. Ashdod, we don't want it. Gath, you want it." Gath said, "We don't want it. We got to take it someplace else." And so they really had something that they didn't know what to do with, but they know they didn't want to have it. So Dagon was one of the powerful gods of the Philistines, sometimes pictured as a half man, half fish. So instead of a mermaid, it would have been like a merman. So the way all of this happened was, if you remember the priest Eli, and he had these two sons that were not very good. In fact, they rebelled against God. They broke his commandments. They cavorted with the prostitutes. And so when they go into battle, this was their idea. "Let's take the ark of God, and surely we can't lose the battle with the ark of God." And so they were defeated. And when the word came back, and both his sons were killed, and the ark was stolen. So when the messenger came back and told Eli, who was 98 years old at the time, he was blind, he was sitting there in a chair, and you probably recognize this story. When they told him, he fell over backwards, broke his neck, and died. And at the same time, one of his daughters-in-law, who is now a widow, gave birth to a child, and they named the child Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. And that really began the ministry of Samuel as the prophet, and things are going to get better. But meanwhile, there's this interesting story about, you know, Dagon and getting crushed by the Ark of the Covenant, or the God who is represented by the Ark of the Covenant. So there's some lessons that we can learn. Remember, we're looking at the message and the miracle. So the first lesson that I get from this, that God is not a good luck charm. God should never be used as a good luck charm. And, you know, you've seen people that have the plastic Jesus on the dashboard of their car. You know, they're sort of, I think, testing God by doing that. You know, there's a part of this story that may sound familiar to you about how they never stepped on the threshold again. They were so superstitious. I know when I was growing up, my buddy and I, we used to always say, step on a crack, break your mother's back. Anybody else ever heard that before? Yeah, so I mean, it's like people sort of practice superstitious things when it comes to faith, and we shouldn't do that. And so God is not a good luck charm. And they thought by putting him out in the front of the battle that they would win the battle. No, you can't use God as a good luck charm. And the Philistines thought, you know what, we've captured the Ark of the Israelites, God, so yeah, we're going to have victory now. No, you can't use God as a good luck charm. But you know, this story actually was some of the basis for a movie that many of you have seen, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. You remember that? Because in that movie, if you remember it, you know, they all tried to find the ark and use the ark because they felt like the ark had some kind of supernatural power. You know, and in the movie, of course, they came out and killed all the Nazis, you know, like that. And so somebody has, I read once that sort of their basis for the plot of that story came from this story of when the ark of the God, ark of the God of Israel had this kind of amazing impact on an idol. Another lesson I learned from this is that the ark had its own agenda. The ark had its own agenda because, think about it, God is all powerful. And of course, the ark was nothing but a box, okay? It was a box, golden box. And on top of the box was a lid with figures of two cherubim with their wings outstretched toward each other. And inside the ark, as we said, it's just a box. There were the Ten Commandments. There was a bowl of manna that had never spoiled. And there was Aaron's rod or staff that budded and even produced fruit. That was inside the ark. But it was to represent in the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle the presence and the power of God. So, you know, God being God, he didn't have to allow the ark to be stolen. Don't you know, he could have just kept the ark from being stolen. Absolutely. So what was the agenda of the ark? Well, God said, I'm going to let you guys take the ark because I just want to show you that your idols are not God at all, and that I have even power over those idols that you have. Israel was defeated by the Philistine army, but when God allowed his ark to be taken there, God defeated the Philistines to the point that as soon as they can, they're going to take the ark back and just leave it there with the Israelites. Here, you can have it. We don't want it. And so, you know, sometimes when we try to set our own agenda for God, God says, no, you're not going to set my agenda. I have plans. I have purposes that I'm going to carry out. And so we should always be looking for God's plans, not our own agenda. You know, I read a guy that was talking about this miracle. And he was writing about it, and he said as a child, when he first heard this story like I did, he was really into, like, professional wrestling, which is an oxymoron, right? And he said he pictured this match as sort of a WrestleMania sort of event between, you know, you have on this corner the God of Israel, and this corner you have Dagon, the idol god of the Philistines. And this is what he wrote. I envisioned the nervous idol marking the sun's descent through one of the temple stone windows, reluctant to be left alone with the Ark of the Covenant, though unable to confide his fears. He was stone, after all, and could not speak. Then the sun would fall, and the golden cherubim atop the Ark would limber their wings. with a flash of gold in the darkness. They would descend to Dagon's shoulders, take hold, and cast the false god down to the ground. In my mind, the two knights compressed into one. After the first body slam, Dagon struggles to his feet. The cherubim fling him to the ground a second time, shattering his appendages. "And you better stay down," the angels say. And Dagon knows better than to try to get up the third time. So that's what this guy sort of pictured like WrestleMania. That's an interesting way to look at it. And the third thing that we learn here is what we sometimes sing. There's no God like Jehovah. One of my very favorite songs. There's no God like Jehovah. And there are many, many gods, small g, in the world, but there's no God like Jehovah, like Yahweh. I'll give you a little staff background. There's kind of a little running joke that's gone on for years between Mike Parks and Ken Warren. You know, I love Ken, but, you know, Ken, he can be a contrarian. He admits that, you know. So every time we sing this song, you know, there's no God like Jehovah, he refuses to sing that. So he wants to just sing there's no God but Jehovah. And he tries to tell Mike, you know what, those lyrics aren't very good. They're not theologically correct. So that's just this ongoing kind of friendly kind of thing that Mike and I and Ken have been doing for years. But the Bible does say that there are many other small G-O-D-S who are false gods. They're not real gods. But there is one true God. And, you know, God really, this one true God has revealed himself to many peoples and nations that maybe didn't have access to the Bible. I'll never forget the very first time I was in Beijing. This has been probably 15 or 20 years ago now. And I visited what they call the Temple of Heaven. And, you know, they practice emperor worship, but yet in this Temple of Heaven, there is a higher God. In fact, they said this is an unknown God who is known only by his name. And then you start talking about this unknown God who is higher than the emperor, and you start comparing it with the Hebrew God of the Bible, and there were too many similarities for me not to know that somehow the one true God of the universe was trying to reveal himself to the Chinese people centuries and centuries ago. And, you know, there was no competition going on between Dagon, because Dagon was just a rock idol. But, you know, there's a little application I learned from this, that all of creation praises God. That's what the Bible says. All creation praises God, even the stones, right? Even the stones. You remember we were talking about this last Sunday when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. You remember in one of the gospel accounts, I think it's in Matthew, the people are praising him and the Pharisees say, "Tell the people not to praise you." You remember what Jesus said? He said, "You know what? If they don't praise me, the rocks will cry out and praise me." You know what that's all about? All of creation praises the one true God. So now we come to, as I mentioned, this plethora of miracles with Elijah and Elisha. And we're going to settle into this for quite some time because there are many of these miracles. And so now we come to miracle number 42, and it is with Elijah, and it's drought and ravens. And we're going to find this in 1 Kings. So turn over to 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1. 1 Kings 17, 1. Now this is when Elijah shows up for the very first time. And boom, we're just sort of introduced to him here. Chapter 17, 1 Kings. Now Elijah the Tishbite from the Gilead settlers. Well, first of all, that lets us know that Elijah, you know, he doesn't have a fancy background. These are what you'd call kind of rural, kind of country, backwoods kind of people. But yet this sort of backwoods kind of prophet shows up and he appears before King Ahab. Now, we're going to be talking a lot about Ahab over the next few weeks because he's in several of these miracles. But Ahab was this terribly wicked king of Israel whose palace was there in the city of Samaria. He was married. One of his wives was Jezebel, who was the power behind the throne. And she hated the God of Israel. She introduced Baal worship into the palace, and she had many of the prophets of God put to death. And so, you know, God didn't like this. So Elijah just shows up and he says to Ahab, "As the Lord God of Israel lives, in whose presence I stand, there will be no dew or rain during these," notice he didn't say days, he didn't say weeks, he didn't say months. He said, "in these years, except by my command." So if you know the story, there's going to be 3 years of drought, no dew, no rain, until Elijah prays. And that's one of the miracles that we'll get to down the road. Verse 2, "Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'Leave here, turn eastward, and hide at the Wadi Cherith, where it enters the Jordan. You are to drink from the Wadi.'" The word Wadi just kind of means a valley, sort of where a stream is. "You are to drink from the Wadi. I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there." So he proceeded to do what the Lord commanded. Elijah left and lived at the Wadi Cherith, where it enters the Jordan. The ravens kept bringing him bread and meat in the morning and in the evening, and he would drink from the Wadi. But then verse 7, "After a while, the Wadi dried up because there had been no rain in the land." Now, you know, when we talk about Elijah, he is one of the most important prophets in all of the Bible. What do we know about Elijah? Well, we know that in the New Testament there at the Mount of Transfiguration, there are two people that showed up talking to Jesus. And you know who they were? Moses and Elijah. And the Old Testament ends with this promise in Malachi that before the coming of the Lord, Elisha is going to come and announce his coming. And we know that John the Baptist fulfilled that role of Elijah in the New Testament. So he's a very important, powerful prophet. And when he comes on the scene, he just shows up to the king and says, "You know what? It's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain, because you have allowed Baal worship to take over here in this northern kingdom." So, you know, again, what are the messages that we learn in this miracle? Number one, when you spend time with God, you can stand before anyone. You can stand before anyone. I want you to see what Elijah said over there. In the last part of verse 1, he said, "As the Lord God of Israel lives, in whose presence I stand." In other words, he says, "I am in the presence of God. I stand in the presence of God. I communicate with God." And he is not afraid to stand before who is the most powerful man of that part of the world and say, "You know what? It's not going to rain. There's not going to be any new dew, any moisture. There's going to be the worst drought that Israel has ever known, and I'm going to do it, and it's going to be years before it happens." And he's not afraid to make that pronouncement to this king because he has spent time with God. And you know, that's what Jesus told us and his disciples. He says, you know, when they drag you before the judges and the courts and they prosecute you, he said, "Don't worry about what you're going to say, because in that moment, I will give you the words to say." And there's a real important lesson here that I think we can take away from this, that sometimes God calls us to solitude and silence. So, you know, here's this prophet. He comes on the scene. He preaches one sermon. And then God says, "Okay, now I want you to go hide out. Go hide out in this wilderness wadi on the east side of the Jordan River." And you know what we learn as we follow the chronology? He doesn't go back to Israel for 3 years. And you'd think, you know, his ministry is just starting. You know what prophets like to do? Prophets like to preach. They like to proclaim. So I imagine had Elijah been given a choice, he would have kept on preaching about God's wrath in anger against the idolatry of Israel. But instead, God says, "No, you're going to go here and you're going to stay there, and I'll take care of you. Someone has said that he entered God's witness protection plan. Because I'm sure Ahab and Jezebel would have found him and killed him if they could. And you know, when you think about the ministry of those who led in the New Testament, almost all of them had a period of time when they sort of got away and alone with God. Jesus, 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, fasting and praying. And we have this strange verse in Galatians chapter 1 where Paul says that after he was converted, you know, converted on the road to Damascus, he said he went down to Arabia for 3 years before he ever came back to Damascus. A lot of people think he might have gone to Mount Sinai, because we believe that's where Mount Sinai is in Arabia, as I've been telling you. We don't know what he did, but all we know is it was kind of like God taking him and putting him in sort of what you might call boot camp. And it's interesting, we sort of think we know where this wadi is or was, but the name Cherith, it's Wadi Cherith. We know what the word Cherith means in Hebrew. It means to be cut down, to be cut down. And, you know, maybe Elijah in the beginning was just a little bit sort of too big, and maybe he got a little presumptuous. And so God had to sort of put him away in silence and solitude for a while so he could get to a position where he could really use him. And, you know, I have found that to be true sometimes in our lives. I mean, sometimes the Lord will sort of slow us down. You know, I've visited many people in the hospital, and, you know, they'll say something like this, you know, I don't know why this happened, but it has really made me slow down and think and really commune with God. Have you ever thought about that verse in Psalm 23 that says, He makes me to lie down in green pastures? You know, I think there's value sometimes in God just saying, slow down, be still, and know that I'm God. In fact, I kind of got this train of thought from this commentator who's pretty famous, Arthur Pink. This is what he says about this scene. The prophet needed further training in the secret life if he was going to be personally fitted to speak for God in public. The man whom the Lord uses has to be kept low. Severe discipline has to be experienced by him. 3 more years must be spent by the prophet outside Israel. How humbling. Alas, how little is the man to be trusted. How little is he able to bear being put into the place of honor. How quickly self rises to the surface and the instrument is ready to believe he's something more than an instrument. How sadly easy it is to make of the very service God entrusts us with a pedestal on which to display ourselves. And so Arthur Pink says, you know what, God had to take Elijah and like cut him down to size before we could really use him. You know, and a third lesson message in this miracle is this. And you know what, we've seen this many times. God will provide for his own. So here he is out here in the wilderness with nothing but a brook, a little stream to drink water from. And God, he has an interesting catering service. He used ravens. And you know what's unusual about that is ravens are unclean animals in the Old Testament. They're not kosher. And the God would even use crows, ravens, to feed Elijah and I. You know, you've probably seen videos of mother birds feeding their baby birds, and it's not something that really is appetizing if you know the truth about it. But somehow God brought bread and meat to Elijah all during this time. And his name is Yahweh Jireh. Our God will provide, the God who provides. And you know where God first used that name? In Genesis 22, when Abraham took Isaac up on the Mount Moriah, where the temple is today. And, you know, and he says, and Isaac says, where is the ram? And Abraham said, God will provide. And my friend, I just want to assure you tonight that whatever you're going through, he will provide. All right, last lesson here is don't panic when your brook dries up. Don't panic when your brook dries up. Because here he is. God, you said you were going to take care of me, and this brook there's no water anymore. So what's going on? Well, if you look down there in verse 8 real quick, this is the next miracle that we'll look at next week. Then the word of the Lord came to him, get up, go to Zarephath that belongs to Sidon, stay there. I've commanded a woman who is a widow to provide for you there. So you know what? God will always guide you if you're following his plan, and he will always provide whenever he guides. And you know, sometimes God can take negative experiences in our lives, like a brook drying up, and turn it into something positive for us. And so I don't know if you've ever gone through a time in your life when your brook dried up. Maybe it might have been your income that dried up for a while. It might have been your health that dried up for a while. It might have even been your joy that dried up for a while. But when that happens, don't panic, because God will provide. You know, in Enterprise, Alabama, which is a city in southeastern Alabama near where I grew up, Enterprise is a county seat, and they're the county squares like we have in a lot of places in Texas. And there in the middle of Enterprise, Alabama County Square is a huge monument. And on the top of that monument is a boll weevil. A boll weevil, seriously. And there's a great story behind it. Because years ago, all they planted there was cotton. Cotton was the cash crop. But then the boll weevils came in and absolutely devastated cotton farming. And so the farmers found themselves penniless, in poverty, until somebody said, let's try planting peanuts. So they started planting peanuts, and peanuts became a much more lucrative cash crop than cotton ever was. And so they erected a monument to a boll weevil to say thank you for turning us towards something that's better than cotton. And of course, I've seen it before because I've been to that city. But Vance Havner writes about that in one of his books, and he makes this application. He says, sometimes we settle into humdrum routines as monotonous as growing cotton year after year. Then God sends the boll weevil. He jolts us out of our groove, and we must find new ways to live. Financial reverses, great bereavement, physical infirmity, loss of position. How many have been driven by trouble to be better farmers and to bring forth far better fruit from their souls? The best thing that ever happened to some of us was the coming of our boll weevil. So those are two more miracles, and we're going to have a lot more miracles from Elijah and Elisha, because they are men that God used to perform many miracles.